So next up we have Julie Cleo.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Hi, my name is Millie. I'm from the University of Virginia. This paper kind of sort of is in the making, and it's mostly conceptual right now because the data is emerging from the study that I'm doing, which is basically to understand how temporary migrants manage legal precarity in the UK and the US. But the way I conceptualize temporary migrants is somebody who goes to another country but invests quite a lot of effort and money into going to a different country. So I look at international students who invest not just time and energy, but emotions and a lot of money. And they're present in the US and in the UK equally. However, there's some variation in terms of what kind of monies they have access to, which is where the conversations when I was having with them became kind of interesting. So I want to thank my committee and University of Warwick for this opportunity. Let me begin with the idea of money. I'm quite influenced by Zimmel's and Marx's discourse on money. In particular, Marx's idea of exchange and Zimmel's idea of money as a performance rather than money just an object. And I'm going to combine those two in this particular presentation. Okay, so let me begin with Ram. Ram is a young 25-year-old boy who came from a rural part in India to pursue a higher degree in UK. When I asked him, Ram, why a foreign degree in the UK? It's not heard of and you're from a rural countryside. He said, a foreign degree was no luxury. It was a necessary step towards a more secure future. He said, everybody seems to have a foreign degree on their CV in India. I had to get one too if I needed to get anywhere, you see. So as the conversation goes on for 3 hours with Ram, I realized that Ram's desire and necessity for a better future was kind of congealed into this notion of having a degree abroad. So I go on to ask him, you know, how did you make it possible? Like, where did you get your information? How did you get the resources? And that's when he starts talking about these various forms of monies that he pulled in together to be able to make his dream happen. And this is where it becomes really interesting for me because as an international student myself, who's studying in the US and the UK, and I've dealt with two different monetary systems, I realized that his narrative around money was quite different from my narrative about money in the US. And the narrative about money in the US is different from the narrative of money in the UK. So based on different currencies, these people were doing kind of different mental calculations and moral understandings of themselves and people involved in the relationship. So I move on to say, however, this is how I'm kind of placing the current literature. Typically in the immigration debate, there are two forms of money that are talked about. One is money as form of wages, which is predominant in the classical and the neoclassical literature. So you see the migrant as an Hobbesian, individualistic, atomistic actor, opportunistic, who goes to another country, gets all the wages that he needs. There's going to be a balancing of wages, and he will at some point return. However, the new theories on economic labor migration, the NELM, they're more concerned with where the migrant is situated. However, they only look at the immediate network, like the household. A more recent theory that's been kind of proposed by Oxford University in particular is the situated values theory that comes from Amartya Sen, which tries to capture how migrants, when they are at an intersection of different structures, you know, as Patricia Hill Collins puts it, kind of imagine value systems in different ways. So they might imagine their remittances meaning different things for them. So these theorists are particularly interested in how gender, ethnicity, geographical location, and duration of stay actually intersect with remittances and what kind of valuation migrants have. But what is ignored in all of this conversation is, what about migratory investment? What does it mean for the migrants? In fact, why is there only one notion or two notion of money where migrants are concerned? In 2007, Haas calls it the remittance of euphoria. World Bank kind of says that there should be liberalization of taxes and imposition of laws on remittances because it actually provides developmental impetus to developing countries. But is that true? And he calls it euphoria because we do not yet understand how migrants kind of understand money. How to understand money more than as a unit of measurement? What is the realm of value? Can it be reflexive? Are migrants reflexive about their money? Remittances literature actually shows that. Is it a site of contradictions? If so, does it look and feel like the same for the migrants? Okay, so far I've collected 48 interview data with Indian international students. I also have data on other international students, which is not included in this study. I also have an online survey. I'm also doing an autoethnography. I also sit in cafes and kind of steal conversations as they go on around me. I'm also kind of involved. I also took on a part-time job to kind of feel the strain that international students feel when they do a part-time job along with doing a degree on the side. And I was a five-year student in the US while I interviewed the students there. And they come from all parts of India. They come; their genders vary too. This is the realm of valuation exchange that I want to understand. It's like, how do they conceive such an expensive degree based on the fact that they're from India? The exchange rate of my rupee to UK pounds is 105 to a pound. So it's a lot of money. The US, it's 96 to a rupee. So it's a lot of money. So how do they come to say that, yes, this is important, this is what I'm going to do? So this is where Zimmel comes in. I think Zimmel's note on value as a performance, and hence, you know, maybe money can be seen as a performance itself, where you do not see it as an autonomous being, but always as something that is interacting with something else. So in relation and relative to something else. Okay, so this is what my idea of migrant monies is. I want to open up other ways of understanding how migrants come to interpret money and how it affiliates and shapes different social structures and practices around self-worth of migrants themselves. As a result, meanings, discourse, and desires around money often conflict between two logics, liquidity and certainty, with each other. Conflicts that migrants try to resolve with some success. The manner in which migrants try to resolve these conflicts or the totality of practices that they cultivate around money is what I refer to as migrant monies. So I'm focused on the distinction between motion and flow, because that's what remittances is about. Remittances are about flow, and I think motion, theoretically and conceptually, is different from flow, which is affected by medium of exchange and valuation modes. Okay, please ignore the arrows. I couldn't get rid of them, but but in all my conversations that I've had with my respondents, majority of the men, I'm going to kind of give you a brief outline of what I found. I found three different types of monies. One of them is cosmopolitan money, the other one is luck or windfall money, and the third one is family money. I don't know why I call them these, because the luck money is, you know, they, most of them were like, you know what, for example, Ram. When Ram came into UK, his bed was stolen, somebody gave him a bed. So he was like, I got so lucky with the bed, you know, I still have it after 5 years. In order to survive, Ram took a job in a really shitty Indian restaurant and was paid £24 a week for working full time. That was illegal money that he was earning to survive. And he said to me, I was like, why would you work with such little money? He said, I got lucky. You don't understand that money is important. I'm like, do you tell your parents that you earn only £24 a week? Do they know about your financial situation? He said, no, I don't think so. They need to know about that. And that's where the whole idea of family money comes in. I think my respondents kind of live on these different kinds of monies on an everyday basis. They come to UK, they go to the US, negotiating a complex practices around loans, which they have never done before, which is an interesting area of investigation itself, which I think I should do a little bit more on how they kind of get to that point to be like, okay, now I have to go in debt. I'm going to be indebted for this many years. Some of them mortgage their homes. This particular person at a really reputed university in UK worked 7 years, saved up money for 7 years so that he could come to UK in order to be able to have a degree on his CV from abroad. And when I was interviewing him and then I interviewed his wife, I realized that he was at a point where he was not going to get a job. He was planning to mortgage his home, put his home up for collateral so that he could get some more money and stay in the UK and see where his future actually lies. If not in UK, he would go somewhere else. So that's where the cosmopolitan money comes in. It kind of guarantees liquidity. It guarantees that you will be able to get quite smoothly where you want to get. But they are very expensive. They come at an emotional cost. They produce a lot of friction. So kind of conceptualizing it like that. The other dimension that I kind of noticed was it's quite, because these guys are young, they think it's okay to gamble. It's okay to gamble with this cosmopolitan money. So youth kind of intersects in this really strange way where it makes them feel invincible. It makes them delay. In fact, this guy that I was talking to you about who saved up for 7 years, his wife would not have kids because she knew that her husband, was speculating on the future. So in the conversation, she was really upset about not being able to do what the other women could do of her age. But she knew that everything would be okay. She didn't know where the money would come from, but it would be okay. A lot of my respondents live on luck or windfall money. And they typically come from either friends. I saw this in Chinese students a lot. I know I'm not supposed to present their data right now. But a lot of Chinese students kind of transfer money from each other's accounts to help them, to kind of save them during their visa processes, mm-hmm. to show more money. Didn't see that with the Indian respondents, but I have a feeling, because I'm an Indian, Indians are quite judgmental, and they will not talk about their illegal practices quite openly. So, you know, I kind of have to coax them to kind of talk about the illegal practices where money is concerned. And then strangers, for example, Ram. Ram had a really bad experience at the university where he was, especially when the university crisis was happening in the UK. He had to shift universities and he needed £4,000 to be able to transfer to another university. A stranger walks in, sees him sad and says, "What's wrong, Ram?" He's like, "I need £4,000 tomorrow so that I can enroll and keep my visa alive." And the man is like, "Okay, here, take this." And he gives him the £4,000 as a gift. Now, I don't know what's happening with the luck or windfall money. Theoretically, conceptually, I don't know what's going on. Maybe it's survival money. I don't know where it's coming from. I don't know why it's important, but I do know there's something emotional going on over there, just something that I need to kind of unpack. The family money is, in the remittance literature, that's what the remittance literature is about. It's about community. It's about family. However, what I found, there was extremely high degrees of moral evaluation. So the money practices are really secret. It's not a communal practice. It's not as though they share information about everything that goes on. They keep it a secret. They will say things like, "Oh yeah, I'm fine, you know, I just bought a computer." But they will never disclose how much. They might buy a second-hand computer, which doesn't work that well. But, you know, as long as the family is happy, they are happy. So there's a lot of the secret works in order to protect the family. So the family money is kind of complicated too. In that case, you don't have liquidity because they do feel the weight of the money on them. Sorry. And they're socially quite expensive too. In any case, so this is where I want to push the paper, especially in the immigration debate. Is there a space to talk about money? Especially money as an investment versus remittances? And how can we look at these different practices based on gender and age and nationality in particular? That's it. Thank you.
Nasty one.
Sure.
I suspect you should look more closely at that quotation from Zimmel. That's why I was fidgeting with my tablet.
Okay.
Because something seemed wrong in that use of that quotation. Yeah, that's from the historical development of money from substance to function. And what he's talking about in that section is precious metals. So when he's saying value depends on their performance, he's not using performance the way we use that word now. That's the first problem with the interp. The second problem with the interp is that he's talking about precious metals.
I haven't read that book. I know that I've read bits of Philosophy of Money, and that's where I got it from. But so I'll definitely have a look at that.
Yeah,
but thank you so much.
Definitely have a look, because
but that's the thing.
You down a strange.
Yeah, but that's the thing about Zimmel. I think for Zimmel, unlike Marx, I don't think so. Zimmel looks at money as a commodity per se. He looks at money as a performance, as a storage of value, as a system that kind of portrays what somebody wants to invest in it as an image. So I feel like he's more Durkheimian than he's like Marx. But then again,
definitely traction for you with Zimmel, but that might not be the way to find it.
Okay.
And we can absolutely have a chat with Zimmel later.
Cool.
If you'd like.
Cool. Thank you.
Millie, I think it's a really good study, and I can't wait to read your final PhD. It's really very interesting.
Thank you.
When you were talking about the three kinds of money, I wondered if there was a fourth kind as well, which may relate a little bit to some of this speculation, that there's an imagined future here.
Yeah.
There's a future where this degree will have been absolutely worth the thousands and thousands of pounds that I'm spending.
Yeah.
And I was wondering what kind of stories about a future in employment might have emerged when you were talking, if there were any...
I think you're right. I think I've been talking about... I think there are actually four different types of money if you look at my PhD as a thing on legality. I think visas are a currency for a lot of migrants. I think their CVs. We were talking about this earlier. I think a lot of migrants in my study talk about how important it is to go to Oxford vis-a-vis go to Sussex because Oxford will give them that cachet. Not necessarily a niche, but a cachet. Like, they can actually trade with it. When they go for interviews, that it'll be really good for their CV. In fact, the work I'm right now doing on part-time basis, I work with a lot of immigrants there. And they make decisions based on where they want to work, based on geographical location. So this guy from Greece, for example, he will not take a job anywhere else, even though he can, because he knows that if he has Oxford on his CV, he will have a better future. So the whole, the speculative game about the future, and I think that's where the youth comes in, maybe, I don't know why, but they feel that they can play that game. But I know that if I interview somebody who has a child, for example, that speculative game will become a game of fear. Mm-hmm. And then they'll make decisions based on completely different bases. But yeah, thank you. That makes sense.
Thanks. I thought it was great too. And you asked this question, is there a space for talking about migrant monies? Well, I think there really is. I think you've shown us that there is. And what I really like is that, you know, you've moved the focus from remittances because it fulfills a very lovely Western agenda, doesn't it?
Does.
Remittances. We
it
want
does.
To look at these poor people. So
get all the bike money. Yeah.
It's uncomfortable, isn't it?
Yeah.
All those people coming here and actually we rely on them for our jobs now.
Yeah.
And so I think it's quite nice to shift the agenda.
Thank you.
We should continue.
I think that's what my anger is with the migrant literature, being a migrant myself and has invested so much in a foreign country to see copious amount of literature on remittances that migrants send back. And to some extent where remittance is actually seen as you're taking away money from us that belongs to us, to kind of shift the focus and say, hold on, let's look at migrant investment monies and then compare remittances and then have like a rational, logical conversation about this.
I think that you maybe shouldn't broaden it out to look at other students. You know, students from India are a big enough group, and you're looking at those in the US and the UK.
Yeah.
I think you introduce too much variation if you start, you know, although there probably are unified themes, but I think personally, I think it's better to focus on that.
Okay. Thank you.
I suppose it was more of a comment because I could I could sort of see the risk and return pressures that were being applied in these circumstances, you know, which would be interesting to dig down into a little bit further. And I'm not sure I agree that it is just about youth. I think people, when they're facing particular pressures that might move them toward migrating, there are different windows at which it will happen. You know, I'm probably a living example of that because I never planned to, and at age 31 I did. And I have friends who did it at age 40 with two children and a mortgage. And so it's really interesting how these pressures can build up and move people to
a different,
take tremendous risks even when they have dependents. You would think they wouldn't do it.
So it is
okay. I mean, the world is a dichotomy of people who don't have to worry about that and people who have to think about, you know, I used to joke I need a visa to go to the bathroom because traveling on a Jamaican passport just made you a complete pariah. So to shift over to another passport changed your status as a global citizen.
It did, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, it does. I think you're right. I think my reservation about that comes from this hope that migrants might not gamble away their future and their family saving. I think what the other bit that's interesting about this study that I find really intriguing is how capitalism has actually, globalization has actually shaped India to kind of open India up to this international market of degrees where, you know, students are no longer thinking about education, but they're thinking about degrees as commodities. And they're dealing in this commodity market as high-risk individuals, not realizing what they'll do. And some of the conversations I've had, they've come back to me and they said, do something, Millie. Go out, do a protest. You know our stories. You know, why can't you do something? And I'm like, I'm sorry. Like, you know, I don't know what I can do for you. All I can do is talk to you guys and publish a study on this. But, you know, their realization of what the extent of the risk only happens once they are here, which is the sad bit of the story. And I think there might be a discourse on information and the gap in information.
There's a biological programming there that makes us do things like that, though. It's really better not to know.
Maybe.
The way we wouldn't do it.
Maybe.
But just to pick up, I mean, I completely agree with Shireen because I think you already have a tremendously rich data set. And it did just occur to me from a very limited exposure to my own students that there might even be a history of migration in the family within the country. You know, having moved from east to west or north to south, etc., which might also enable the family to say, take the chance.
Yeah.
Because the family already has a history of taking a chance.
Yeah. I am kind of looking at, so my interviews are historical narratives about their migratory journey. So I go back to the point where they think they kind of realize, I want to go abroad.
Yeah.
And I would say Apudarai fits here more than anybody else because it's not so much the family, that the Indian family, because these are rising middle-class families.
Yeah.
The parents never did think about going abroad. It's the kids who are looking...
I don't mean abroad. No, I meant within India.
Within India.
So people who are now living somewhere used to live in another part of India.
Yes, maybe, yeah.
Because if you look at the sort of change in transportation, etc., at one point,
I agree.
Moving from one part of India to another would have been a really big deal.
I agree. I think you're right. There's been a lot of movement from the rural to the urban in this case. Thank you.
Last question. Thank you. You talked a lot about risk, and unless I misunderstood you, one risk you didn't talk about so much is actually failing to get the qualification.
Yeah.
And that, I mean, you know, we sit on the other side of it, and there's always a few. And even and then PhD level, there's a few more, and you start to see sort of big situations and kind of loss of face as well and all sorts of, so I wonder if you wanted to dwell on that at all.
I'm kind of conflicted because, you know, I feel I'm a bit too close to the data right now. But to be honest, I've had a few stories.
I think you'd be all right on that one.
I've had few conversations where, you know, like circumstances happen and, you know, there have been some conversations where students have told me, you know, my father just died and I have to take an exam. And, you know, because of my visa, I can't seem to, like, shift and go back. Or, you know, I need to finish my requirements. If I don't finish it, I will have another semester of £9,000 to pay. So, you know, I think in terms of failing and not doing well on the degree is so closely tied in my data with money, it's not funny. Like, you know, they will risk not going to school and not doing their homework because they need that money to survive, because they did not think that things would be as bad financially in the UK. It's, however, different in the US, because I think US does a... I don't want to be judgmental.
Go ahead.
But US does do a better job of kind of informing students, you know, these are your financial requirements, these are the things that you will have to face for. When students come to UK, they have absolutely no idea. It's a Plato's cave. They're just exploring it. And they stumble and they fall while they do it. So I would say, yes, it's a big concern. I mean, policy-wise, UK needs to address why is it that international students, when they do come to